Good morning, happy Mardi Gras, and welcome to our meeting. It is 9:00 on February 21st, 2023. The time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Wolf, President of the Commission. My right is Commissioner Sid Logan, Vice President. To my left is Commissioner Tony Olson, Secretary. John Harlow, CEO General Manager, is at the head table over there. Joe Fina is Acting General Counsel right here. Melissa Collins is our Commission and Executive Services Director. Allison Morrison, to my left, is Clerk of the Board. Jenny Rich is Deputy Clerk of the Board at the sign-in table. And Morgan Stoltzner is our Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board and CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. I'll now recognize our CEO General Manager, John Harlow, who will facilitate the discussion. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. Hope everybody had a nice President's Day weekend. So we're gonna switch up the rotation, or the agenda a little bit. We're gonna start with Scott Jones to give us a little bit of a financial update. Scott is involved in interviews today, and I think Scott's special anyway, so we want him to.
Yeah, not my interviews, just to be clear.
Although we do get very nervous when you come up with this.
I'm tied up most of today with a variety of other competing things. And John and I had a couple of things we wanted to mention this morning. So I'm rushing in to do that before I rush back upstairs for some interviews. We had an interesting couple of months that we wanted to kind of give you as an example of how sort of the confluence of financial things is happening. There's also been a couple of questions about where we landed for the year. You've got in your packet sort of a final look at how we landed. So we had something interesting happen at the district these last couple of months. We had what we think, based on the records we've looked at, what we think are the two largest disbursement months, outflow months, in the district's history. So we normally, and we track this stuff very closely, certainly for the last several years, December and January were enormous disbursement months. Now, if you rewind back and think about why, there's a variety of things that happen that we've talked about to you, but we haven't put all these puzzle pieces together. We had a very large storm in November, and we had a couple of other smaller events in November and December. The storm in November was very expensive. And of course, we had a lot of mutual aid, which comes in later. So a lot of times we don't find out what the mutual aid is for another 30 or 60 or 90 days.
Expensive equals dollars, $100. Is it too soon to come to an end?
No, that storm is probably a 15-ish million dollar storm. Again, it takes a bit of work to piece together what that precise number is. But early on, we kind of quickly thought, yeah, this one's going to be, you know, at least 10. And then we kind of started thinking, yeah, it's probably 12. It's probably closer to 15, you know, when the dust settles. We've got some other events that kind of trickled in too that also were, you know, could have been $1 or $2 million events as well. The other thing that happened in December, as you all probably heard when we talked a little bit about some of these things, is we had an incredibly cold late December, which created tremendous havoc in the electricity markets. And so when you take that combined with our need, we do our best to do projections a month ahead, and we buy power based on those projections. When those projections are a little bit off, it doesn't take much. But if the projections are 5% off, then we have to go into the market to replenish that 5% of power. Market prices in late December were crazy. Market prices in the last part of the year were very high, but December was particularly bad. So you have this situation where we have a storm, some smaller events, we have incredibly cold weather, We have forecasts that are a little bit off, not for anybody's fault. It's just we do our best efforts, and then based on water flow, based on temperatures and everything else. And so that then spills into market prices were outlandish. And listen, I mean, not a little bit up. Market prices were outlandish. When you add all that together, come January, we're paying mutual aid, we're paying scheduled debt service, we're paying PTO payouts for employees and all these other things that are happening on top of bills for market prices and everything else. So we ended up having two of what we think are the two highest disbursement months we've ever had. Now, let me rewind for a second. We've been talking to you all in a very cautious way about reserves, right? And so you've heard us talk about, you heard me at this podium talk about last year and then this power 2 years ago and then through this budget cycle. The uncertainty that we have about a variety of different factors. The market prices are huge. They're a huge factor. And Jason and all of those really talented folks that we have do a wonderful, wonderful job of protecting us in that space. But there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty in that space too. I'm not going to say lucky because we did it intentionally, but the one thing we could control was we took a very conservative approach on reserves, and you all were supportive of that. And so I'm appreciative of you all being supportive of that, and I thank you for it. As we went into November and December and we were talking to you about the budget, we have a 120-day working capital requirement. We were hovering in the 135 to 145 days. And that saved our tail. And there's a couple of reasons why. It saved us generally because we went into the year and went into this uncertain few months with a bit of a conservative posture. But the other wrinkle to this, and this is wonky finance stuff, if we have to unwind investments in order to replenish cash, that actually costs us money. And we actually could have been in a situation where we were unwinding investments that were not in the money. So imagine you buy Apple stock, you know, and you want to sit on it, and then it tanks, and then you're like, uh-oh, I need that money, and you've got to sell it at a loss. That would have been the position we would have been in. We would have been in a position where we're holding investments with slightly lower interest rates in a rising interest rate market. Had we not had a little bit of that cushion, we would have been in a position where we might be having to break investments, and it could have cost us a few more million dollars. And so one of the lessons here is when we look and see a degree of uncertainty, we're trying our best to protect, to predict those times. And when we do, sometimes we get lucky to predict those uncertain moments. When we have a conservative posture on reserves, it saves our bacon. It really does. And so we ended up having a time where, yes, retail revenue had an uptick because of the cold weather. So we'll start seeing some retail revenue coming in to replenish. And we were in a conservative posture anyway, so the reserves have landed in a good place. But it's a nice reminder of sometimes we get these moments where there's a confluence of things, storms, market, cold weather, you know, a variety of other things that really could put us in a tight spot. And so I think that conservative posture that we've generally had, that philosophy that we've had, really helped us. The only other quick thing I'll mention is we've been sort of looking at the projections that we did versus how we landed in the year. It was very difficult to project December. December was crazy. But where we landed, when the dust settles, we were pretty close on the reserves. We were a few million off on our projections versus where we landed, but it wasn't a ton. And so with all these movements and things that we had, we're actually in an okay place on reserves. And so I think I still, looking back, would stand by the things that we talked about in November and December. of, we took a conservative posture, we put in a very small rate increase, and I think we did the right things along the way. So I'm appreciative of your all's support for all those things, because it worked out okay. That's all I was going to hit on, John.
Yeah, and I think you did cover it, but just to make sure, we had a question. What was the net impact to reserves? We exceeded net income and underspent CapEx. And as Scott said, all the different moving parts, we basically landed where we had forecasted to land in our reserves.
Right. We certainly landed close enough that it wouldn't have impacted our recommendations. Is probably the way I would say it, for sure.
And it sounds like the bill's coming in January or February.
Yeah. January was, so we had an investment committee. I mean, we got a group of people that sit on an investment committee. We monitor this stuff pretty closely. We've got a lot of smart, talented people that do that stuff that are much smarter than I am. And it was alarming when we went back and started looking at the disbursements, and we started thinking, wow, you know, this is an interesting moment. So I think the main thing we wanted is just to give you a flavor of, we've had a moment, and it was an interesting moment from an operational standpoint, and it spilled over to a moment from a financial standpoint. I think we weathered through that in a pretty good way, but it'll be a reminder as we go forward that, you know, when we start seeing some of those pieces of uncertainty, this is one of those moments where we can say, yeah, we've been through that. And you know, it can get dicey. But the district has a long history of being very conservative and taking a conservative posture, and I think that's great.
Right. And I wouldn't use the word long.
Oh, well, I'll say this. Well, so long as I'm the CFO of this organization.
No. Long 10 years.
Yeah, and the previous CFO was
not well done post that.
Yeah, the previous CFO certainly had a very conservative perspective too, at least in the few years leading up to when I got here. And so Glenn, my predecessor, deserves a lot of credit there too, because he put this organization in some very good financial footing when I got here. And then so long as I'm here and I get the support of the CEO, we'll remain fairly conservative on that front because it's paid off. Sorry, John.
No, that's good stuff. The other thing I was going to mention, and actually you're the one that had pointed this out to me. The question mentions that we underspent CapEx. Well, we underspent CapEx in large part on two big projects, AMI and the North County, and both of those are bond funded. So that actually impacts the cash outlay on the CapEx. So it looks a little bit deceiving that we are underspent on CapEx, but we did spend cash. And I think, I don't know how far off or how far underspent we were on normal CapEx, pulling those two out.
But much closer, yeah. And in fact, I think there were some places where we were more aggressive on CapEx because we had the capacity to do that. But the majority of the underspend on CapEx is related to bond projects. It's a great point, John. And so it does look deceiving because your instinct is to say, oh, well, that's more money sitting in reserves. But in that particular case, it's more money sitting in a bond fund that's being waited to spend.
Do we have anything that's comparable to money market funds, or is that comparable to the reserves?
So
in a regular account, like I think I have a money market fund.
Let me answer that as simply as I possibly can. For our operating capital, which is this main reserve that we look at, this 120 days, right? And it floats to 120, 140. Most of that money, well, practically all of that money, is put into very short-term investments, right? Because we want to have the ability to access it if we need to. And so essentially what happens is, for that and for all the other reserves we have, it's basically set up, imagine you've got a portfolio of CDs, right? Certificates of deposit. And imagine every month you buy a new CD. And so every month you've got a CD that expires, right? What we're doing is very similar in the investment community, right? We're buying investments in a staggered way. When they expire, we repurchase at the prevailing rates that we have then. And depending on the fund we're talking about, those could be very short-term investments. Imagine a three-month CD, or a very long-term investment like a year or two. we operate that portfolio the way you might think of your own personal money, right? We've got money that we can access very quickly and easily, which would equate to your checking account. And then we've got money that we can get to if we need to, but we like to try to get it earning a little bit more than the basic checking account, right? That's where we come into short-term CDs, medium-term CDs, long-term CDs. In your world, we're operating in a similar fashion. And so when I said earlier, well, if things were really bad and we had to go break those investments, imagine you had a six-month CD that was earning 3.5%. You're getting the 3.5%, you want it to go to term, but if you have to break it, you know, in order to get that cash for an emergency, then you don't get some of that. And in fact, you might lose it. So that's the same philosophy that we're dealing with here. Is it's a staggered investment approach. We try to just let the investments go with the market. When we have to break those investments, it's not a good thing. And so, yes, we have a variety of those kinds of funds.
Okay.
Is that helpful?
Yes, it is. Yes. Thank you.
It's kind of a question. So speaking of philosophy, I guess I still wonder whether we have the right mixture of risk with holding on to power of selling it long term. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't celebrate the months where we sell power on the wholesale market
right.
a year in advance, or and
right.
But we you know, are always concerned about these winter months.
Yep.
When we've sold length in the past, and now right. we need to go out the market and buy it. And I'm wondering, you know, our weather just seems to be more volatile.
Yep.
And so our forecasts are going to tend to be less accurate. I wonder if we need to relook at that mix, that risk reward. And of course, it comes right at the, you know, December's fix the year-end
right.
actuals and everything.
Right. Yeah, so arguably one of our most volatile months just so happens to unfortunately be the last month of the year, right? And that's why we go into the last quarter of the year going, you know,
yeah.
I'm hoping I'm predicting storms correctly and the market correctly and the power supply correctly and the weather correctly and all those things. Jason and his group are largely responsible
right.
for that, and they do a great job. I think they would tell you if they were here, they would say, you're absolutely right. There is an increased amount of volatility in the market. There's just no question about that. I mean, with weather volatility, and that spills over into precipitation volatility and everything else. I think from a risk management standpoint, we're doing a very good job. We are in the middle right now of a review of that risk management policy to give some updates to it. And so we're constantly looking at that. I still think no matter how tight that risk management process is, and John's going to agree with this comment, no matter how tight that risk management policy is, that piece of our business is the one piece that will keep you awake at night.
Sure.
Generation supply, near term, short term, medium term, is going to be an important piece of this business, no matter how much we perfect an IRP or perfect risk management. So, Jason and Garrison and those folks are doing wonderful, wonderful work, but they're doing it in an environment that just has an inherent uncertainty to it that is just not, you're not going to manage your way out of that uncertainty. Now, I will remind us for all of the doomsday stuff that I'm sitting here talking about, we had a really, really good year for off-system wholesale sales. I mean, we had $20 or $30 million above budget, I think, on wholesale sales, and we're projecting to be quite a bit above the norm for this year too. So you live by the market and you die by the market, right?
Yeah.
So when the timing's right and it works out, we can reap the benefits of some of those prices. When it doesn't work out, we have to kind of, you know, we have to participate in it on the other side. But it is, there's a lot of volatility there. It's something that John and I've talked about many times. The one thing, if you let your brain chase it, it will keep you awake.
Yeah, it's well said, Scott. And there are conversations going on, and I will say lessons learned and how can we be better thinking about managing the risk going into months like December. And I know Brian was involved with this, Garrison, Jason, Scott, and his team are really thinking through how do we better prepare ourselves or mitigate that potential risk, especially in the Decembers, the Januarys, the Februarys, better, or and even upstream, the October and November, because there's just so much going on.
Yeah, with global warming, I've read a long article about weather in California and all over the whole U.S. And California is going to have cold weather for a while and a lot of snow in the Sierra Nevadas, and we're going to be getting more snow maybe here. So it's, you know, it could be good. That could be good. I don't know.
I mean, listen, the weatherman has been wrong since I was on the earth. But it does seem to be getting worse. John, I hate to duck out. I do have a couple of interviewees waiting on us.
You may be excused. Thank you all
so much. If you have any follow-up questions or anything, please reach out. I'll be happy to help and support.
Thank you. You have a lot of observation, but you go. Go to your interview.
Thank you.
John, it's my recollection that if you're looking at other than process with regard to the risk management policy, isn't that a policy that the board approved years ago? Mm-hmm. Does it come to the board?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And I do want to say to my fellow commissioners, you know, I'm sure you've been asked and I get asked, you got all those millions of dollars sitting around. What do you need? I want a refund. I want a refund of that money. And it's so complex to explain why. And I personally am thrilled with the conservative. I might like a little more in the project budget, but
a little more what?
A little more reserve in the project budget, but I'm not gonna press for that. But it is, don't want to talk about history here, but when you're faced with Enron and no reserves, that is scary.
Yeah, that'll definitely taint how you
do. So anyway.
Yeah, and again, the team is constantly thinking about how do they run the process, not just from a philosophy standpoint, but better data analytics. They're engaged with the data analytics team. How can they use that data? How are we making sure we are informed and using all the different indicators, key indicators, economic indicators, market indicators to help us just continue to try to refine that margin of risk.
So who is replacing Brian Booth?
We are going through the process to find that out. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think the interviews start either this week or next week.
Yeah, we need that person who wrote. We need her.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. All right.
And you know, I accept the risk. I think the risk doesn't bother me, but we just seem to. I wonder if staff accepts the risk because we sort of, like I said, we sort of perseverate a bit on the bad, the losses, and we don't really celebrate the wins. And I know that we've got wins to go with losses. So maybe there's a graphical way or something so we can understand as we go through a year that balance.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we can explore that.
Yeah.
See if there's a better way to
change our fiscal year so we don't end in December.
You could do this for once a year.
Yeah.
All right, next up on the agenda is our legislative update. Ryan Collins is going to provide that.
Good morning, Ryan.
Great.
Good morning. Welcome. How's everyone doing? Good morning, commissioners. I'm Ryan Collins, Senior Government Relations Program Manager for the district, and I am here to update you on the current progress of the session down in Olympia. Thankfully, they are less volatile than power markets. So we are on day 47, which is approximately 40% of the way through session this year. Of note, we've already passed first cutoff date where bills need to be out of their respective policy committees. We're anticipating a bit of a downshift since we've passed that policy cutoff date, the policy cutoff date typically means that no newly introduced bills will have enough time towards final passage. While we cannot predict what the future will hold, I am confident to say that we are unlikely to see any new bills being added to the key legislative report going forward. For your guys' reference, the next policy cutoff date to be aware of is February 24th, which is this Friday, when bills need to be through their respective fiscal committees, and then March 8th, when they need to be off the floor of their chamber of origin. With that, let's dive into the report. Of course. First up is HB 1032 and its Senate companion SB 5039.
Okay. I do have a question.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
On the government relations activities page, I believe there is no commissioner going to the APPA LNR. Is that correct? Correct.
Unfortunately not.
That's correct.
Yeah, and nor am I. And in terms of a voting delegate, the board assigns that among us three commissioners. So should the board staff recommend who will represent us in a voting, and we then delegate that. I delegate it to you, and then I don't know. I think we should approve whoever's going to vote on our behalf.
Sure, we can go through that process.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. It's actually going to be Melissa, so I hope you will delegate either myself to allow Melissa to be our delegate, because I'm going to be out in DC Saturday, Sunday, and I come back late Monday night. And Kim is going to be there, but she's going to be engaged in meetings. So we thought it was still important for us to have a delegate, yeah, and participate in that process. So,
yeah.
I didn't know that. I wasn't aware of the formal process, but.
Oh, I don't think it, yeah, there's no formal process, but I was just thinking.
Yeah.
We do assign ourselves. So I think we should give a head nod to who John
did. Melissa.
And thankfully, Melissa is able to, you just made your reservations like. Yeah, a couple days ago, because we weren't sure on schedules between you and I.
Well, I'm sure Melissa will do a great job. As president of the board this year, I would have also loved to go, but I accept, you know, the judgment that was made. So that's how it is.
So we're all good with that?
Yes.
Okay, excellent.
Okay.
Back to you, Ryan.
No problem. So yes, first up on the report is HB 1032 and its Senate companion 5039, which would require electric utilities to create wildfire mitigation plans. As the bill has advanced, there have been several small technical changes that we view as positive. Those changes move the authority of the program to the Department of Natural Resources and away from the Energy Resilience and Emergency Management Office in the Department of Commerce. They also remove several requirements that the utilities believe would have potentially infringed upon our local control, and incorporate additional feedback from local fire protection districts. Both House and Senate bills are scheduled for public hearings this week, and to move forward, the bill will have to move out of its policy committee, or excuse me, its fiscal committees this Friday. Next is HB 1117, which addresses the state's planning in response to potential power supply inadequacy events. You may recall this bill sailed through the legislature in 2022, but was vetoed by the governor. The amended version of the bill modifies the scope of what the working group should consider. The new language moves away from addressing the extent of rolling blackout risks to addressing strategies to ensure power supply adequacy. The amendment also removes language that stakeholders must be explicitly surveyed for recommendations on policy options. Since the bill has minimal fiscal impact, it has been referred to the House Rules Committee and is waiting for action. Next up is HB 1192 and its Senate companion SB 5165, which aims to increase transmission in the state by adding several transmission planning requirements to utilities' integrated resource plans. Since our last report, the bill has gone through both policy committees and has been slightly amended. Some of the technical amendments further clarify when certain transmission projects need to go through the Energy Facility Siting and Evaluation Council, or FSEC, process, as well as clarifying that local government permitting processes remain available for projects outside the scope of the FSEC process. The bill appears to be moving quickly, and it's already undergone public hearings in its respective fiscal committees, and is likely to move to the floor soon. The governor's office and the bill's sponsors continue to extensively engage stakeholders on this legislation. Snohomish PUD has been actively engaged in these conversations to ensure that this proposal reflects the unique perspective of the district. Specifically, we are supporting statewide efforts to build additional transmission. However, our utility, we do not own and operate transmission. Instead, we rely on contracts and agreements with others, primarily through BPA. As such, we are working to ensure that the bill correctly applies to this utility, as well as other utilities that do own and operate and build transmission. Are there any questions? Okay. Next up is HB 1216 and SB 5360, which would reform the clean energy siting process to make it easier to site more renewable projects. Stakeholder engagement with the environmental community, businesses, renewable developers, utilities, and tribal communities ongoing. It is anticipated that the new language will continue to evolve based on these types of conversations. Like the transmission bill, this remains a priority of the governor's office and is now going through review in its respective fiscal committees as well. So several of the changes to the bill reflect fine-tuning around coordination and process of siting clean energy projects by the key state agencies, primarily Ecology and Commerce, as well as amending provisions to the State Environmental Policy Act, or SEPA, that would shorten review by agencies for certain projects. Like the transmission bill, the siting bill appears to be moving pretty quickly and will be seeing more action soon.
So this bill makes it easier to site projects? It's reducing existing regulation.
That is the intent, yes.
Yeah,
so it's they've shortened the time frame for certain projects under SEPA to 24 months.
I think that's happening federally too. Same approach.
Correct. I believe, yeah, the EPA. Exactly. Yeah, the idea is that to make this slightly easier for utilities like Snohomish to build projects.
So if we were going to site a pumped storage project, then Washington State University would have to conduct an analysis. And it says least conflict siting process. Does that mean they may say there's a better place for our project?
So I may kick this to Marion Dock, who's our contract lobbyist, and she's been following this pretty closely. Marion, are you online?
I'm on the line. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. So Commissioner Logan, that's a great question. The details remain a little unclear of how that process would play out, but I will say there is currently a lease conflict solar siting process ongoing at the Department of Commerce. And through that process, they are not dictating where, as of right now, where projects can and cannot go, but they're hoping to identify priority zones that might be best suited for these large-scale renewable projects. So I think they're hoping to replicate that type of a discussion on pump storage as well.
That's a good question.
I was thinking about local control when I was thinking about.
Might happen.
Yeah, I was just thinking if a utility, if we wanted to site a project and in our service territory, and an agency looks at that project and say, well, there's a better place to site it over somewhere else. So
and there's so many other things that go into that.
And then there's, yeah,
it's
there's
a complicated process.
There's cost.
It's just.
But I guess that was my first question was, this is a bit of a relaxing in some regards. Well, I'm not sure if it's relaxing with the pump storage or not. But we've already lost local control and maybe we're gaining some back. But the pump storage is concerning to me.
Absolutely. And I understand that this is very much, the bill is really still undergoing active negotiations. And this is very much a fine tuning of trying to kind of make sure that the process can move forward quickly, but still apply local control when possible.
Thank you.
But we'll
monitor. No. Please go on. I just, mm-hmm. You open up that little hole and then it gets bigger and bigger.
Completely understand. All right. Any other questions on siting? Otherwise, I'll move on to heat moratorium. Cool. Next up is HB 1329 and its Senate companion SB 5366. Which would prohibit utility disconnects during extreme heat events. This legislation requested by Attorney General Bob Ferguson would prohibit utilities from disconnecting customers for non-payment during episodes of high heat. The initial proposal was pretty vague on issues such as how to handle situations where temperature forecast was different in different parts of the utility service area, as well as how to handle safety issues associated with reconnecting electricity or water to unoccupied homes, and possible conflicts between labor and industry rules for employees working in extreme heat and reconnection requirements. The current language addresses many of the concerns that Snohomish PUD and other utilities has raised. As such, reconnections during extreme heat events are now at the request of customers, and the legislation now gives the utility the flexibility to enroll customers in a payment plan when reconnecting. We continue to work on the with the bill sponsor to fine-tune the bill and anticipate several more tweaks as the bill moves forward in the process.
How kind of chance are you getting this?
So it's currently sitting in House Rules.
No, I mean in terms of eventual passage.
I think of the bills that we're currently tracking, it's got a higher probability of passing than others. I think we put it up there kind of in the same boat with the transmission bill.
Well, as we work through it, I hate to sound like a broken record, but local control, if you are working to minimize impact.
Exactly. Yes.
That doesn't, minimize doesn't work for me. I guess I speak from history, and it can be really problematic for a utility to open that window.
Absolutely, and I will say.
What does minimize mean to you?
Minimize is we want to make sure this is operationally useful for the utility, and again allows us to have the ability to engage with customers with their rates as well.
I just think it's a matter of balance, Commissioner. No, I mean, we are not in a bubble. We're part of a bigger area, we're part of a bigger state, and we share a lot of the pressures. And so we have to also think of the big picture, but retain the local control that is right for us to continue to keep. So, I mean, that, it is to me a balance of local control, but also thinking of the greater good, you know?
You know, I can appreciate that, but I don't want to be told by somebody that I have to do something for those we serve. I don't want to be told that when I should be making the decisions for those we serve. Yeah, I can understand your balance, but I'm always harping on this because I believe it's extremely important to. That's why we're public power.
I totally agree. That's why it's one of our guiding principles, and we look at that. That lens is on every single bill that we look at. Realistically, anytime we're talking about disconnect moratoriums, that does impact some of your local control. So when we say we're trying to minimize the impact, it's should this legislation come to fruition, we're trying to maintain as much local control as possible and make sure that the way that the bill is written and implemented meets our operational needs and allows us to best serve our customers.
And I thank you for that. So in your reports, as you're working through this, and I know you work really hard on our behalf, that you can explain to me, give me some examples or an example of where I want to say compromise, but an example of what the board might see that this bill would have if it goes through with some losing some control.
I hear what you're saying. I do. And I think an example of current movement that we've seen, the prior version of the bill, you're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong here, but he lives it day to day. But the prior version of the bill mandated that we would have to reconnect anyone that was disconnected when the heat surpassed a certain threshold. Okay. And there were a lot of concerns we had about that from safety perspectives, from practicality perspectives. So we worked really hard with the sponsor to adjust that language to maintain more of that local control. And now utilities do have the flexibility, customers now have to request could they be reconnected? And we have the ability, the flexibility to put customers on a payment plan when they call to do that. Should we make that decision? Should you all decide that that's the right decision? So that's the type of balance that we're working on.
Well, I think you did a good job on the amendment. I do. And also the point about the temperature's not the same in every part of our 2,500 square miles, 2,200, I guess. So, you know, that's a factor.
But I do want to reassure you, we care deeply about it, and it's front of
mind. I understand that, and that's one of your principles, and I thank you for that. That a cornerstone of public power is local control.
I live and breathe it. I promise I'm working to protect it.
Well, and I think this bill contains about it.
Yes,
I remember
you are correct.
It was forecasted temperature per zip code.
Exactly.
We probably got 100 zip codes.
Exactly.
But I do appreciate what you're saying, Commissioner. I mean, the state needs to regulate the for-profit utilities, and legislation.
That's a mess.
Legislation like this, they regulate us a little more. Every bill, it seems like.
But they're working hard. You know, my emphasis is on local control, but when I need your examples, because then I can not be such a
absolutely
difficult person about it.
Not at all, and I'll make sure to include more examples.
Okay,
exactly.
Thank you.
The perfect example is, again, where customers, we were required specifically to go in, and whoever we had to identify, go in.
Put them on a payment.
Exactly, and now we again, customers have requests, which again gives more flexibility to the utility to deal with this. And I will say, this bill has been moving significantly in the right direction, in our opinion. And so we're continue to monitor, and we'll continue to work to make sure.
Thank
and again,
we
get it to a place we like. Next up is HB 1427, which would modify the net metering requirements for electric utilities. As introduced, the bill would alter several components of the current net metering statute, which was updated in 2019. As amended, the bill would require utilities to net meter under the existing compensation model until December 31st, 2029. That changed from the earlier bill of December 2035 as introduced. The current law is currently at June 2029, as well as increase the current net metering cap to 6%. The original bill had it at 12%, current law is at 4%. It also modifies the system size threshold to 1 megawatt, but includes exceptions for systems that might conflict with BPA. Just for reference, the original bill had a cap size of 200 kilowatts, whereas the current law is at 100 kilowatts. And the current threshold for BPA is at 199 kilowatts. We have been active in conversations with the bill sponsor, the solar industry, and other utilities on the right approach that continues to support the solar industry, but also allows utilities to move to a more equitable rate of compensation for residential solar, which in turn would be more equitable for all of our customers.
So does the legislature think they understand the inherent unfairness to customers?
We have been communicating that pretty consistently.
They can afford it the least.
Exactly. Particularly for public power, there's absolutely a cost shift from non-solar users to solar users. In essence, we're subsidizing them. And as we've seen in multiple studies, most individuals who are able to install solar on their residential homes tend to be more affluent. So. And we have been communicating that pretty consistently with the bill sponsor, as well as others, other legislatures.
1996 peak demand. How does it compare to today? It's way lower then, right?
Yes. So are you referring to like how we ended at 1996, or kind of where we're at to the cap?
Well, how it compares to today. And so you expect that we will reach 4% by 2029. So where are we today within that range?
Absolutely. So we're at 51% of our way to the 4% cap, if that makes sense.
Okay, yeah.
There has been increased solar adoption in the last couple of years, which probably the rate of increase is accelerating. But yes, we're about halfway through our current cap.
Thank you.
No problem. Very much. All right, next up is SB 5562, and it's House Companion SB or HB 1589, which is a bill that was put forward on behalf of Puget Sound Energy. As we reported earlier, the bill is aimed at specifying how the company should proceed towards ending natural gas service for new customers starting in June 30th, 2023. The bill has been narrowly drafted to only apply to PSE and has been passed out of both policy committees and is quickly being reviewed by the respective fiscal committees, I think today specifically. We're still reviewing the language with our internal experts to better understand how this may impact grid reliability since PSE has natural gas customers and the district service area.
So this is a bill that PSE requested?
Yes, correct. They put forward it.
What was your question?
If PSE requested the bill.
Oh. Last is a new bill for the report, which is Substitute House Bill 1391. This legislation is new to our key legislation report. It was introduced by Representative Rammel and aims to create a one-stop shop for energy efficiency programs and under a third-party navigator program. Intended to work in concert with utility programs, the third-party navigator would help customers understand which programs they are eligible for, which contractors are certified to install energy-efficient appliances, among other potential services. The bill has undergone several rounds of stakeholder engagement, and the committee adopted language includes language utilities, including language we put forward, to make sure that the navigator works in concert with our own energy efficiency programs. It's currently being referred to the House Appropriations Committee, and again, is also likely to move closer to the floor.
We definitely need this. I'm going through this myself as we get off of natural gas and electrify everything in our home. We're working on it, you know, and I've had to do a lot of my own research, you know, and it's not an easy thing to be, and also the bonuses that PUD, I mean, not bonuses, credits, rebates, whatever, those are only two stores and they're the big, big box stores. And it would be nice if other sales, you know, like more local businesses could also benefit from those.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I can only buy my new induction range from Lowe's or Home Depot if I want credit, you know.
Absolutely. This bill certainly seems to be well-timed in terms of trying to take advantage of.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely, and particularly with the federal funds also coming down.
Yeah, I just mentioned that as an example of what I think many people are going through as they try to remove natural gas in their homes.
Absolutely, navigating all the incentive programs out there is a challenge. And again, I think the intent of the legislation is to simplify that as much as possible for customers.
Yeah, it's a big investment when you do this.
You know, when I first got on the commission, we talked several times about the, I think it's in the state constitution, about the inability to fuel switch. But now we seem to have bills for the last several years. Is this something, I mean, I guess the legislature must be aware. Is there any, we need to fear there's going to be a challenge to some of this legislation? I mean, the constitution is pretty clear.
It's a very good question. And so the electrification bill you're referring to earlier was also introduced by Representative Rammel. I believe this is an effort of his to, again, kind of find another way around a fuel switch aspect, a fuel switch constitutional amendment. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not entirely sure exactly when that line would be crossed. But it seems that the legislature is very intent on trying to find kind of where the cracks might be.
But there's no move to amend the Constitution.
Not that I've seen.
It's not the votes.
Yeah, exactly. I believe it's a two-thirds vote in both chambers.
Fascinating.
Great. With that, any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioners.
Well done.
Great job. Thank you, Ryan. Okay, next up is David Krueger with our community engagement update. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioners. My name is David Krueger. I'm a communications and marketing consultant in corporate communications here at the PUD. I'm here today to talk about one particularly cool way that we get to engage our community that we serve. At the PUD here, we have a steady stream of requests to participate in STEAM nights at local schools, which stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math. Our public education programs coordinators Heather Herbst and Jane LaMarca have been dealing with requests from local schools to participate since in-person learning resumed recently after COVID. And the PUD does all it can to ensure that we meet those requests and get booths to as many schools as possible. So we've talked to students about fun and engaging ways to conserve energy and work with them. We turn to employees in all departments across the PUD to help us staff those events, and they've been incredibly generous with their time. I myself had the privilege to participate in STEAM Night at McElteel Elementary recently, and it was an absolute blast. We had three stations run by volunteers from CorpCom. There was a table focused on making simple circuits. There was a hand crank generator to show the difference between LED and incandescent lights. And there was the skull, scat, and tracks location where I was at, and that had animal skulls, tracks, and droppings, I guess, from animals found in our service territory. The droppings were rubber, don't worry. It wasn't actual. But my biggest takeaway from the event was just how curious and smart these elementary school kids already are.
Oh, yeah.
They were able to figure out what belonged to what, and the amount of kids already knew what bear and deer scat looked like was also pretty impressive. I also pinned up a note that the parents seemed to enjoy playing with the scat almost as much as the kids did. I don't know, but it was just a great way to spend a Thursday night, and it was super cool to see how much of a difference the PUD can make in these kids' lives, outside of obviously keeping the power on and the water running. Even during the pandemic, Heather and Jenny were finding ways to have employees at the PUD reach out and mentor students through Zoom calls and robotics competitions. And I know that we participate in career fairs at high schools, have assemblies at middle schools, and do a bunch more to work with local students. We currently have an art competition and a high school project competition that are going on right now. So if anyone knows any kids who are interested, there's more information on snowpeb.com how to enter that. It's just an honor and privilege to work here with people who are just so smart and go above and beyond to help their communities every day. So thank you so much for your time and listening to me talk about deer droppings. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them as long as they're not about science, technology, engineering, art, or math.
You can see why some people do love teaching.
Yes.
Even in spite of the salaries and all of that.
And I can never do that, but one night at the STEAM is probably what I can handle. So.
Fifth graders especially are just amazing.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm thrilled to do that. It's a perfect time to insert some learnings utility.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun with all of that. So yeah.
And our team does an amazing job.
I know.
They are so creative. I mean, it just blows my mind the different approaches they take and creativity. Right. You as well, David.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thanks for doing that. Have fun.
All right. Thank you, David. And last on the agenda this morning is Derek Harmon to provide the commissioners with an update on our outage alerts, and this is super exciting.
Yeah, and current, yes. And very current.
Yes.
Some tough facts to follow today. So good morning, commissioners. Thank you, my name is Derek Herman, Senior Manager for Customer Service, and exactly, super excited to bring you this update today. So starting with this slide, my name is on this just as the presenter. There are dozens of people behind the scenes that really made this happen. So, and we would be here a long time if I were to recognize all of them. So I'm not gonna go into that, but do know that there are a lot of people that worked really hard on this, and I'm just here to represent it. And then we'll transition from this blue sky intentionally. They could move to the next slide.
I see some storm clouds building.
Thank you. Okay, so yeah, we've got this not so subtle bright blue background as well to illustrate the fact that we're starting with the first rollout and then plan to continually improve the customer experience after that. So starting with blue sky, and I've got some data to talk about the last 24 hours too, to illustrate some of what the customer experience is, which is very exciting as well. So The first iteration is, as I mentioned, just to start with normal blue sky. It's designed to mirror the outage tracker on the outage map, which is on that left-hand side there, so you can see the statuses, outage reported, we're investigating, pending crew assignment, things like that with the ETRs that go along with it. And the process starts when a customer reports an outage on the outage map, and that box at the bottom right pops up and says, would you like to enroll in our outage alerts? And we've had really good reception so far. Approximately, I'd say about 50 customers experienced and participated in this. I'll go to the next slide here.
So over. If you go back.
Yeah.
So if they click this, this gives them notices for this outage or for this and future outage?
Just that specific outage, yeah. And that's how we're starting it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And how do they access this?
So it's directly from the outage map. If you report an outage online,
okay.
Try to make it as seamless as possible.
Good.
Okay, so this is an actual experience. It's one of the first customers that engaged with us last Tuesday when we went live with this. So this experience, you can see, started at about 10:43. They reported an outage, just a local outage. We sent them an alert. Thank you for opting in. Then we sent the subsequent message at 10:44, informed them that we've been dispatched our crews, take a look at it, gave the original ETR, 12:45. You can see that we beat that ETR at 11:50, power in your area is restored. And they were our first customer to participate in the survey. We asked customers to let us know what they think about it. Are they likely to enroll again? And you can see this was our first survey responses. We were waiting, hesitantly, but wanted to see what that those first experiences were like. And you can see, and I think you all know that this is something we've been looking forward to for a long time. So have our customers. So, you know, that response came in shortly after 11:53. Rate your overall satisfaction on a scale of 1 to 10. 10, how likely are you to opt in again? 10, again, how helpful was the information? Again, 10. And,
now this is non-storm, right?
Right.
And it would be impossible to do this. Okay.
Yeah, and to that point, so ECC right now for the outage map, they have the ability to suppress the ETRs. And we get into something a little bit more than blue sky. So what happens with this is that audit, when ECC determines that the ETRs need to be suspended on the outage map, the outage alert opt-in message also comes down. So it's, so that way we're focusing on the blue sky, and we can decide how we're going to implement that in bigger events and things along those lines. So, a perfect example, last night at about 12:43, they suspended ETRs, and then this came down. And we had about 2,200 customers, roughly, participate in the outage alerts before we took it down at a little after midnight. So just to illustrate that that process is already in place and working very well.
Wow, impressive. This is great survey response. Was that John? Was that you? I thought it was like a ringer.
Let me double check. Yeah, and we've actually had, just checking this morning, 216 survey respondents, and 85% have rated a 10. And the vast majority are 8 9s. So customers are really, really happy about this.
Yeah, that's horrible. So you know what this will mean with when people get this service at Blue Sky, they're going to be expecting it.
And we're working towards that.
I know. Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is wonderful.
So you turn this on, I mean, you say opt-in. Is that done from the outage page then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, but as we continue to develop this, the plan is to have folks, once you opt in, you would receive this and you wouldn't have to go to the outage map and opt in.
Okay.
And some companies have gone that way. They've done put everybody in that we have email and text information for, they put them in the system and then they have to opt out. Others have done a kind of a blast opt-in. We've taken this approach. At first, I was a little nervous about it, but I like this. It's a very stepped and methodical approach to get our customers used to it. But I think in the future, we want to be at the place where somebody doesn't have to go on here, right? They have an outage and they're signed up. They're going to automatically get the outage alert that says, hey, we know you're out of power, and the same messaging would apply.
Are there other electric, gas, or water utilities that require their customers provide an email or a messaging information when they sign up for the service?
Yeah, I mean,
we don't do that.
Well, you have to be on, and I should probably let Derek take this. You have to be on.
That was one of the reasons we couldn't do blast, because we don't require that. Am I wrong?
Go ahead. We don't require that. When a customer signs up for service, we ask if they're willing to provide their phone number.
So why do we do that? What I mean, like, the garbage company asks for that so that they can send you information.
Yeah, for us, it's about being able to reach them. Water boil, robocalls or alerts, and many customers they want to receive information from us. And in this particular instance, I'll go back one page here.
But as a public, I guess I'm getting it. I don't understand why, as part of their application for service, that they are required to say that we will use this for alerts. But we're not requiring them an email or to provide a message. Oh, yeah, here she comes.
Are you asking, should we require?
That's a question. We really don't require.
No, we don't.
And why? I don't understand why.
Hi, this is Pam Bailey, AGM over Customer Energy Services. One reason we don't require it is because of the Privacy Act that prevents us. Customers have to allow us that information. But what we are doing with mysnowpud.com, as customers sign up and set up their profile, that's when they can provide us with that information, and we request it at that time.
That is the Privacy Act only applied to public?
No, it's a federal act.
Yeah, it's everybody.
Federal act. So how can these other utility providers require that? Phone companies?
There's
waste management?
There's disclosures that you can give to customers saying what you're going to do with their information, and then that lets them decide if they want to give it to you. And we are working towards that our online platform.
Okay.
So, Pam, when we get into the counter, are we encouraging people to give us that information?
Yes, and we've even had some campaigns where we've reached out and tried to get email addresses and phones so that we can set up text and email, and we'll continue to run those campaigns.
Yeah.
That's a challenge,
right,
keeping it updated.
There's a lot of folks, I guess.
Yeah, and it is a challenge to keep it your database updated as customers change emails or, you know, switch phones, etc.
Accounts get started before people have it in or social.
They often give us just 999 for their telephone number.
There you go.
Well, Verizon, we're hooked to Verizon because they've got phone numbers. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, great questions. And I'll show on this, when they opt in for this specific alert, we provide them the message that says what we're going to use it for, and they enter their phone number that they want to receive it from there. We're not using their accountant at this time. But to John's point, we want to get to a point where the customer can tell us what they would their preference, so that if they would prefer an email versus a text, we can do that as well, so that we're meeting every customer through the preference that they've established in the relationship.
But part of this is when someone goes into the outage map, their lights are out. They picked up their phone, they've gone to the outage map, they clicked on their location, they realize it's an outage. We don't necessarily know who that customer is. So we can't even at that time really necessarily ask them to sign up. We might be having them sign up for outages that will be their residents in the future, right? I mean, we know this outage, they're affected, but we don't know until we have connect up, we have the, you know, the specific meter, when you know that meter is out, it seems like it's a little problematic.
It's not really. If you have a feeder-based outage, we know all the meters that are on that particular feeder. So we can, once that breaker opens, all those customers are correlated, we could send them an outage notification. On the device, once a customer calls in and says, hey, I've got no power, ECC determines through the OMS system what customers are affected, and then we can send out that notice. That's how you do it if you don't have
any meters to sign up, because we've had outages in South Edmonds, but my house and my neighbors were not. I mean, so neighbors who are out for 2 months vacationing keep calling me to say, are we affected? Is my house affected? So I have to get them to sign up.
Please do, yeah.
Yeah, I will.
Wonderful.
Yeah, we're really excited about this. Yeah. And we'll be hearing more and more about this as we go. So
let's thank the whole team.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and one other.
It's a difficult nut to crack, you know.
Yeah, piece of color commentary is, this is probably the biggest satisfier for our customers.
Yes.
And under the JD Powers, it's within reliability. And even though it doesn't necessarily affect reliability, the amount of communication that a utility does with their customers in the way of outage notifications is by far the biggest satisfier. Mm-hmm. So yeah, super excited about this and the impact it'll have on our customer experience efforts. And Derek and the team have just done an amazing job getting this stood up and in place.
And could this also be used, or you probably do alerts anyway now, for planned outages?
Yeah, we do.
And as we get better and better and continue to refine this, storms like we had last night and smaller storms, we will be able to keep this on. But we've got other processes and systems that we need to keep working on. Connect Up will absolutely be a huge advantage in that regard.
Yeah, are there any models that the utilities are using that are successful, that are larger scale?
Yeah.
Expensive ones?
No, not necessarily more elaborate or sophisticated systems. It's just they're a little more mature.
That's right.
So they have better outage restoration data, which is some of the things that we need to continue to build on, and specific to storms. So they have done the data analytics that says, you know, they've got this many customers out, it was this type of an outage in this area, and crew response time for a 24-hour period. So they can give ETRs, not necessarily down to the hour, but a restore by, and it could be, you know, 6 hours from now, it could be 24 hours from now, those types of examples. They usually use a little different process when it comes to storms.
Well,
but it's exciting stuff.
Thank you, Bravo.
So if the ETR is adjusted, will they get an update to text too, if it's changed to a later time or something?
Yeah, there's and to John's point, there's a process and algorithm behind all of that. And as customers share their experience with us and we learn and adapt, we'll make modifications to that, so the experience just continues to get better and better, and we can have more features like you've seen with My Snowbud and the mobile app. So again, this is another great step for us moving forward for our customer experience.
Excellent. Thank you. So that's it from our end.
You know, I was going to say it was wonderful to wake up early this morning and read the Great Herald story we had today. So, thank you. Great quote in there from Mike Harrison. So, I'm glad we were able to do that.
I haven't read the Herald yet.
It's about, there's a quote in there about that, you know, we're very confident we have adequate resources.
Oh, I've been telling people that too.
I know. And I have too, but I like to see the newspaper say it. So
it is now 10:09.
And the board will recess into executive session to discuss the performance of a public employee under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meetings Act. It is anticipated that the executive session will last approximately 60 minutes and will conclude at 11:09. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m. Thank you. It is now 11:11, and the executive session will be extended for another 30 minutes. Let's see, what would that mean?
Conclude
11:45. We will conclude at 11:45 or before. Thank you.